This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
I'm flying over backyards, country homes and ranches, watching life between the branches below. And it's hard to say who you are these days, but you run on anyway, don't you, baby?
Welcome back to Sunday Groove, episode 19 on Place to Be Nation Pop. If this is your first listen, it's just simply a music show where I talk about a different thing each month, a different music topic, with usually a different guest. I'm always the host, David Sunday, and I just go to different people and get them on the episodes. So this episode, I'm bringing back someone that's been here several times. Three times. And that is the host or co-host of Hard Traveling Fanboys, Talking WCW, and the pod blast that comes out sometimes on the wrestling feed as well is What If Wrestling. Greg Phillips, how are you tonight?
Thank you very much, Mr. Sunday. And you had it right the first time. I am the host of the Hard Traveling Fanboys, and on my back, I carry the gargantuan physique of one Nicholas Walter Don Brandenburg Duke the 17th. And we are the longest running weekly episodic comic book podcast in all of Place to Be Nation. And I thank you, David, for reaching out to me and having me on for what promises to be an intriguing and highly intellectual discussion between two geniuses in their crafts.
Hey, I don't think I signed up for genius discussion or any really that much intelligent discussion, but maybe it'll happen on accident.
Maybe. I mean, you never know. With us, I mean, gosh, even our most benign conversations turn out to be thought-provoking, intellectually stimulating, and just overall interesting.
Well, if they're not benign, they could be 10.
You know what? I approve of that. I'm gonna allow it. I doubt that the listening audience will approve of it, but I approve of it, David. That's all that really matters.
The other thing is great is I did the Andrew Garner double clap pump.
Ooh!
The only
ooh.
Thing that came through, of course, was the clapping.
Yes.
But that was there for us and him.
For a little bit of inside baseball there, our good friend Andrew Garner, one of the best people on the face of God's green earth, is also one of the foremost clappers on God's green earth. The man can create acoustics from his hand that make John Bonham's drum set sound muted. It's incredible.
That is actually very accurate. It's amazing. And he when he really approves of something, he would do a double clap and a pump.
Double
fist
clap,
pump,
yep.
Yeah. And so, anyway. Well, I wanted to say at the beginning of the episode, I just really wanted to say thank you to Todd Weber, who is our manager at Place to Be Nation Pop. He did my first 18 episodes of this show, and because he's doing some of his own shows now, and he steps aside, and I actually have Andy Helene. So I guess technically he might be a producer on the show. I don't really know. So long-time guest appearance occasionally, or say occasionally, several times. He's the new editor, so I just want to throw out a little love to him on that too, because I'm very excited to keep going. As Todd has recently launched, I think, two or three shows, so he's a busy, busy man.
He is, yes. He is currently throwing several shows out on the Pop feed. We've got Conversation Comics, which he's kind of the spearhead for alongside Tim Capel.
Yeah.
And he's also got Binge Please, where he's talking about some of these streaming shows out there in the world. And there's some other projects, perhaps featuring him coming down the line, which I'll let him announce at a
right. Oh yeah, time. I'm not going to announce those for sure. The bench please, I always kind of like to think of it really sassy, like bench finger snap please. Just in case the finger snaps didn't come through,
I was going to say, I audibly said, finger snaps are definitely more effective if you say that they're finger snaps after you do it. Sort of like Street Fighter when you say Hadouken right before you do your big move. I bet the opponent will see it coming now.
You know, I'm thinking I've probably already lost several listeners this episode so far, so maybe I should actually get to the topic instead of just randomly talking about stuff.
No, don't worry about that, David, because once I share this on my Twitter account with all 800 of my followers that ignore all of my tweets, then it's gonna reach the masses.
My 51 or whatever the hell it is. it like, thanks to bots, it occasionally gets up to a higher number, but it always tends to get dropped down after, like once a month or so, I guess, once those bots get discovered. I'm thankful for the bots. It makes me occasionally think more. I have more subscribers, not subscribers. What are they called? Followers.
Yeah.
Anyway, so typically on an episode, I talk about current spins, and that is just anything that I've currently or recently been listening to. It doesn't have to be just new music. So, Greg, you're the guest. Do you have any current spins this month?
I do, David. And shock of shocks, virtually none of mine are new music. So, there is a little bit in there, I guess, but new to me anyway. So my mom actually, when I visited Mobile about a month ago, which is where I'm from, Mobile, Alabama.
Mobtown. I visited
Mobtown, the 251 as we call it,
yes.
Down there on the streets. But I visited my mom, and she got me onto this band that was one of her favorites as a kid that she's recently rediscovered called Dr. Hook. And so I've been going through the Dr. Hook catalog. I had never really heard – the only song of theirs I had ever heard before this past month was on the cover of the Rolling Stone, which is a pretty famous song that they did in the early 70s. But I started delving into their catalog and quickly discovered that they're a pretty cool band, and especially their live performances are really good, energetic, funny. They kind of split vocals on a lot of songs and – had a really cool kind of diverse career with some almost disco era kind of stuff along with country themed stuff and everything in between. So I've been listening to them a lot. I've been listening to a little bit of James Brown as a result of a UFC fighter that made an entrance to a great James Brown song, and I've been listening to a little bit of his output especially from the 70s, the super heavy funky stuff. And then also a new band that I discovered actually just this past week, David, not a new band, but a new to me band called The Main Squeeze. And, they did a cover of the Led Zeppelin song, No Quarter, which caught my eye. I always like to check out Zeppelin covers to see if they're any good. And, this one was very good. In fact, I would go so far as to say it's one of the best Zeppelin covers that I've ever heard. And it was so good that I saw another one of their covers that was trending, which people were talking about, which was a cover of Pink Floyd's Have a Cigar.
Yes. And I listened to that one. I was blown away by it.
Dude, so good. The guitar solo at the end was just face-meltingly good. And then I listened to some of their original stuff. And they have they're big on the tour circuit, mainly. They do a lot of festivals and stuff. But they have some original songs that are really good, really creative. It just feels like a band of great musicians, and their vocalist is good, and everybody is good at what they're doing in the band. And in particular, their guitarist is spectacular. But so I'm gonna try to in the next couple weeks try to get some of their albums if they have any on Amazon Music and listen to those, because they've kind of gotten my attention, David.
Yeah,
that's what I've been listening to.
I found at least one of theirs on Amazon Music. I haven't listened to them, but just one song so far, which is great. Mainly because I was just prepping for this episode, along with just random other stuff get in my head and I have to listen to. Well, cool. Yeah, I actually got distracted and never listened to their No Quarter cover, but that Pink Floyd one blew my mind. I was really impressed. Like, I knew it was good because you love that era of music that mm-hmm. they're covering. And so, like, for you to say they're good, I knew they'd have to be good, but, like, I wasn't expecting that level. Like, I was very impressed. And even vocally, like, I really like his voice.
Yeah. It's very distinctive. It's very powerful. And it's unique, which is most important. It's a unique sounding voice that gives the songs a distinct flavor. Like, I think what they do with their covers is the perfect way to do a cover, because it's honoring the original while putting their own spin on it and doing it in a way that is distinctly them, that is different. It doesn't sound like Pink Floyd doing it. It sounds like them doing it. And I think that's a very good approach to have. They're not dissecting the song to where it no longer resembles what it was, but they are doing stuff, instrumental flourishes, vocal touches here and there that make the song their own. So I'm a big fan of that approach.
Right. Yes, I totally agree on that, because I have a big love-hate relationship with covers sometimes that
right.
sometimes it's so much like the original that it's just like, I'd rather just listen to the original. Mm-hmm. But then you go the way where you're just like changing too much and it really, you lose the song. Like I always go back to it. I hate Gavin DeGraw's cover of We Are the Champions because he just goes all over the place. Like I know he can do vocal runs. It's like he's trying to be a male Christina Aguilera, but I don't need that where you're losing the melody of We Are the Champions. And to me, that just ruins it. So,
agreed. Yeah.
So yeah,
we've all heard covers like that, that are like, they dissect the song to the point where it really isn't that song anymore. It's something totally, and if you do it to such a degree that it is an entirely new song, such as you get in a lot of the 60s and 70s covers of old blues songs, that's one thing. But if they're still trying to maintain the fidelity of the original and yet dissect it and tear it apart and twist it into something that, like, that is not the song, you know, that to me, that's where you lose it, especially if it's a great song that they're covering. If it's not just a good song that they're covering, if they're covering a great song like We Are the Champions or covering, you know, something like Stairway to Heaven or No Quarter or something like that, and you turn it into something that it's not, a lot of times it loses me. Sometimes it can work. There are exceptions to every rule, but I'm with you, David. I think that song you mentioned from Gavin DeGraw stands out. A lot of times when people try to make these songs, they'll try to take an existing song and try to, like, pretty it up, you know? I don't like that. I think some right. songs are just better left in their original stripped-down kind of format. But yeah, totally good point, valid point there.
Awesome. Well, I have a varied list I'm going to try to go through pretty quickly, but so I guess starting, well, a little over a month ago, I'd watched Captain Marvel. I guess it was the weekend it came out. Yeah, I think so, or the weekend after. It was somewhere around there. I loved its soundtrack, but I also rewatched the movie Tag, and it has a lot of fun hip hop within the soundtrack, and it just kind of reintroduced me to one song that I hadn't thought of in a long time, and that's Boyz II Men, Motown Philly. That was a lot of fun. It was really cool coming back to that one. But it introduced me to two songs I don't think I'd ever heard. And that was a song called Runnin', and that's by The Far Side. And that's PHARCYDE, Far Side. It's just a fun rap song. Never heard of them before, but it stood out in the movie to me. And maybe check out the song later. And then also a song by the Beastie Boys off of Paul's Boutique album called Shake Your Rump. And it is just a lot of fun. Like once it gets like a minute or so in, like it's just got a really cool bass groove and stuff going on underneath the rapping that I love it. The sampling is so incredible on that album. They went really sample crazy on it. It's really cool. So yeah, obviously a lot of people have already talked about Captain Marvel soundtrack. It was great, but Tag, it's a funny movie. If you hadn't seen it, it's on HBO Go right now. And I like the soundtrack. It's fun. It's a very fun, different type of movie. And for a modern comedy, it actually hits way better than a lot of them, dude, for me. I'm a comedy connoisseur, guess that's what I'd say if I'm trying to sound pretentious. But like, I love comedy. It's my favorite thing out there. Like, it's so I watch a bunch of crap, and so when I see one that actually works, I really gravitate to it and watch it over and over. And it really pulled off some cool action as well, and that was pretty impressive. So anyway, but I have some actual current stuff that I wanted to mention real quick. And this one really caught me off guard this week. One of the Facebook groups I'm in, they share music, and a song called Purpose for Pain got featured in this week, and it's by Mr. Scott Stapp. And I almost didn't listen to it because I expected it to be like a lot of his stuff.
What's the name of it again?
Purpose for Pain.
Okay.
Anyway, it's not groundbreaking, but I like it way better than a lot of the other stuff. It didn't feel as overly produced like some of the stuff on his second album. Like, his second album did seem like they tried a little bit harder to not just be Creed. Like, his first solo album just really tried to be Creed. His second one from several years ago was doing a little better, but it just felt like overly produced, and I don't know, I didn't like some of it for that reason. But this one I liked. I don't know. I'm still reserving judgment. I'm not getting like overly hyped for it, because I know it could go anywhere. It could really just try to be nothing but Creed on the rest of the songs. But I liked it. The album comes out in July. I actually didn't write down the name of the album, but anyway, if you want to hear something different by him, try it out. Like, it's definitely a rocker, but like I say, it was refreshing, and I'm hoping
hopefully he's turned the corner in his personal life.
Yes, the interviews I've been reading with him, there were several released this week along with that song, sounds like he's back to where he was at the beginning of the Full Circle, what's the name of the one in 2009?
Yes, that was the Creed album.
Yeah, the one that he came back for, like, right when they were getting started, where he was. I think he quickly reverted back to a lot of his old habits after that, just hearing stories from Tremonti. But I think as far as emotionally and maturity-wise, at this moment, he's there. And if he is completely clean like he says he is, then, you know, more power to him. I hope success for him. Because I know there was a lot happened between then and now. Anyway, definitely not trying to talk bad about Scott Stapp. I'll love early Creed, there's definitely some problems emotionally and personality wise with him at times.
Yeah, but yeah, I'm with you. I enjoyed their last album, the last Creed album. I thought it was good record, and I thought it was a little somewhat unfortunate that even though I prefer Alter Bridge, it was somewhat unfortunate that things broke up with them. But I'm glad if he's getting it turned around in his personal life, that's a good thing.
Right. Yeah, if he keeps it like that, I would be up for a Creed reunion eventually, as long as it doesn't interfere. I think it'd have to be way down the line, just because all the members have so much stuff going on.
Right.
But I think it could be cool, because I really enjoyed seeing it in 2010, I think it was. I caught a show on it, and it was really good. So, anyway, some other new music real quick. There's an artist, her name is Hannah Anderson, but she goes by Sister now when she records. And she has a fun song called Love Me Right. It's got a really cool groove, and she's got a good voice. So if you're interested in that, check that out. And then one last surprise. I had no clue that this was ever going to happen again, because Jack White has a pretty strong personality, and also does like a million projects. So I didn't know this was ever going to happen again, but apparently the Raconteurs are back together. And they have a new album coming out on June 21st of 2019, this year. Duh. But it's one song called Sunday Driver, which is incredible. I love it. It's a very good rocker. And then a little more of a mellow one, Now That You're Gone. Both of them are available to listen right now. Like I said, the album comes out in June, so I'm sure at least one or two more songs will come before then. But very excited for that. I know I didn't get the first album when it came out, but the second one I got pretty quick when it came out and got really into it, and it got me really in a Jack, maybe a Jack White fan. So was very happy to see that, because not to be ugly or whatever, but I definitely prefer this over The Dead Weather, as one of his supergroup things he did. I like this one a lot better.
Yeah, one of my biggest memories of the Raconteurs, I remember that album, their first album that came out with, was really good, and I remember they were on Jules Holland, who does a music show on some network, and out of England, and I remember for some reason, this is the one thing that sticks out in my mind every time I think about them, is Jules Holland introducing them as the Raconteurs.
Yeah, I remember you mentioning that. That's great. Yeah, it's considered a supergroup. The one of the other dudes is very well known in another band, but it's not something I've ever checked into. He's probably great, but I don't know. The Raconteurs, I just always get excited. Because, like I said, it's been a big break. Like, it's been, I think, 10 years since the last album, so it was not something I expected. Typically, if you're gone for 10 years, there's probably some reason. But maybe not. Maybe they were just busy with side projects. I know he's done at least a couple solo albums. He did The Dead Weather. I don't know if there's been any White Stripes reunions along the way or not, but could have been. So anyway, that was just I just discovered maybe Thursday or so, both the Scott Stapp and the Raconteurs thing. So that was all new information to me. But anyway, that's longer than I meant to talk about during Current Spins, but I just had more this month than sometimes. So, so Greg and I started spitballing probably 2 months ago, I think, maybe a month ago, I don't remember, of just some possible ideas we could do for future episodes, or just that he was mentioning just if I wanted to use with different guests or whatever. And one that stood out to me, and I could see him light up a little bit with it, was the concept of hidden gems. And I'm not sure what his finished product will be with it, but I know most of mine, I think actually all of mine, are established artists. But it's an album by them that I don't think gets as much love as it should. Or maybe it does, and I'm just not aware of it, and I want to point it back out to people, because the thing with established artists is that they have a lot of stuff out there. Some things are going to get more attention than others, and some might get completely overlooked. So, yeah, it's a pretty simple concept. Is that kind of where you went with it, or did you go somewhere different?
Sort of like that. Where I went with it was really albums that I felt are overlooked historically, looking back on it. And in some cases, these are very well known artists. I think I've got one or two examples in here of lesser known artists.
Okay.
That might have a classic album in there that people need to check out. But a lot of times it's just an album that maybe if you look back on the history of this individual artist, you might overlook it in their pantheon. You might, think to their classic albums, and you wouldn't necessarily pick this one out as one of their best. And so, there's one case in particular where it certainly isn't one of their best albums, but it's still an album that's worth listening to. And so that's kind of where I went with it, is stuff that I feel like people might overlook, and if they give it a chance, they're going to find some stuff on there that might be some eye-opening or ear-opening type music for them.
Nice. Okay, sounds like we're pretty much on the same page. I know I'd done a similar concept a little over a year ago, but I went way more obscure with it that time and just went with artists that was most of mine that probably hadn't been heard of. So Greg, what is the first one you want to talk about?
Well, to start things off on my rather eclectic mix, I've got a very, very diverse list in terms of genres and musical stylings. The first one that I'm going to start with comes from that lesser-known artist I was referring to, and he's a country artist by the name of Jamie Johnson.
Oh, okay.
He is, and the album, to get that out of the way, the album that is here on my list is called That Lonesome Song. It came out August 5th, 2008. This was his second album at a major label. And it's kind of an interesting departure from his first album. Jamie Johnson, for those that don't know who he is, he's a big, chunky guy with a long beard who has aged a lot in his time in the music business. But he's also one of the very few people fighting and hanging on to real country music in Nashville. So take the sound that you might hear flipping through the radio station right now, whether you're a country fan or not, you might be flipping the radio station and you might hear a certain weird synthesizers with fiddles sound coming from your speakers, whether that be from the likes of Luke Bryan, whether that be from whoever the flavor of the day is in country music. Well, just take that and throw it in the trash, because this is completely different from that. This is, and that's nothing against people that like that kind of music, because I think even those people will enjoy this. This is a throwback album. This is an album that sounds like it could have been written by Waylon Jennings in the 70s. It sounds like it could have been written by Randy Travis in the 80s. It is a throwback country music sound from a guy in Jamie Johnson who is a throwback country music artist. He's a great guitar player, one of the best in Nashville, and also hails from my home state of Alabama. So in our home state of Alabama, so that's pretty cool. He's from Enterprise, actually.
Yeah, I just saw that.
And you know, he's such a talented artist. He's got this, you know, kind of baritone voice on him, and has a twang in his voice, but it's not this fake put on twang. Everything about this guy is legit. And this album actually, I think, is on a different label than his original album was. And this allowed him to kind of get more into the style that he wants to tell, which is a lot of sad country songs. That's what he loves doing. He loves doing reflective, lonesome, you know, songs about loss, songs about struggle and pain. And this album in particular has a couple of my favorite songs of his, including The High Cost of Living, which is a powerful song. I actually cried the first time I heard this song, because it reminded me so much of my dad, and he did as well. And so it's a very powerful song. A song called In Color, which was a big radio hit, I remember at the time. Probably his only big radio hit, actually, to date. And that's a good song as well. And then Between Jennings and Jones is another one of my favorite songs of his. It just demonstrates his clever songwriting and storytelling that he has in his song. Storytelling is the key to country music, and Jamie Johnson is probably the best modern country music storyteller that I've heard. At least he's in that discussion along with Chris Stapleton and a few others. But yeah, he's outstanding. This album is, I listened to this album just yesterday to prepare for this podcast, to make sure I wanted it on my list. And it's just a phenomenal throwback country record. If you want to know what real country music sounds like, listen to Jamie Johnson, and in particular, listen to this album.
Nice. Yeah, he's one that I keep meaning to listen to more. I've heard a couple songs off this album and love them, but he's just not somebody I think of very often, sadly. I know I've considered seeing him in concert, and will probably one day, just because I do like his style a lot. I love either 90s country or like outlaw country. That's pretty much what I get into as far as country goes. I remember he randomly played at a Lit concert I went to back in like 2013 or so, because he had become friends with Lit, because the guitarist went from Lit, played in Nashville a little bit, like prior around that time. And apparently now they're kind of doing country-ish songs now themselves. But anyway, I just remember it was hilarious. Like, they're playing a concert and they're like, hey, we're going to invite one of our friends from Nashville to come out. And I definitely did not expect it to be Jamie Johnson. You know, this guy with a huge beard, long hair, and a cowboy hat probably, and come out on stage with Lit. Definitely not what I expected. But yeah, he's really cool musician. I need to check out more.
And it's you mentioned he's not one that you think of a lot, and I think one of the reasons for that is he's kind of overlooked by the industry, because I believe he hasn't had a full-length record since 2010. He had a little Christmas album that he did in like 2012 or 13, but he hasn't had like a true studio album since like 2010. And he makes most of his money by songwriting and by playing in concerts. So, you know, it's kind of unfortunate that this is a guy that has not found a level of sustainability with his records that he has with his live performances. But, you know, that's just the way things, you know, how trends work in music. So,
I think his shows tend to sell out, if I remember correctly, because I want to say he played at the Wetumpka Casino, and that sold out, I'm pretty sure. And I think the one in Montgomery might have sold out one time when he played. So at the Impact, Montgomery Performing Arts. So I'm going to catch him one of these days. But I wanted to throw out some attention real quick to apparently there's a writer on one of these songs for The Door Is Always Open, the name Dickie Lee. Now, do you think that could be a guy responsible for the song Dickie Ride that I remember bringing to y'all's attention probably several months ago or a year ago?
You know, it's possible, but then if you click on his Wikipedia page and you look at the guy, I can't see that guy writing the song Dickie Ride.
Hold on.
He looks like a shaved Burt Reynolds.
He does. That's exactly what I just thought. But in all seriousness, apparently the dude from Lit was there even sooner because he helped write a song on this album. Jeremy Popoff is the guy's name, the guitarist from Lit. So yeah, apparently, no wonder.
Down the Roses, yeah.
No wonder. Okay, I couldn't remember the timeline very well when they had that concert. So yeah, that's pretty cool. But in all seriousness, what I've heard of Jimmy Johnson's awesome. He's one of those I need to go back to. I know there's some not as going to just do the generic modern country sound. Someone like Chris Stapleton, he's had a lot of success. Mm-hmm. And I guess he is a little more mainstream than Jimmy Johnson, but he's still not what I would consider, you know, mainstream country of like.
And as much as I love Jamie Johnson, Chris Stapleton is able to cross over because of his incredible voice. So
that is true. That's one thing I wasn't thinking about.
His voice
is better.
He's got a voice that is unmatched in country music. So that'll go a long way.
Yeah, I guess that is part of the reason why he's had more success. But I guess I just mentioned him just because I think of them in the same sentence just because they don't seem to just give in to the trends and just be the Florida Georgia Line or the, you know, bands like that right. are the type of country that I can't do. So
neither can I. I've been listening to country music my whole life, but I'm the same way.
Right. Anybody that's listened to the episodes of my show, pretty much the only country that's been mentioned on the show with anything positive has been Garth Brooks, Lindy Ortega, and Chris Stapleton. That's pretty much who I've talked about because that's the style of country I like. Well, when we first mentioned this topic, this album immediately came to mind. It is an artist that I've talked about extensively a year and a half ago. But if I mentioned this album, it was such a brief mention that I really wanted to put it on this list because it belongs on this list. And that is Tom Petty's album, Highway Companion.
Yes.
From 2006. Yes. This is technically his third solo album. And I say technically just because it's funny to me that he always brings in the Heartbreakers, at least some, when recording the solo ones. I think there's different songwriting styles and different ways he approaches the songs. That's why he doesn't consider them Heartbreaker albums. But like sometimes, like his first two big albums that were great, they still at moments it sounded just like a Heartbreaker album. Like at least a couple songs.
Yep.
This one doesn't. This one sounds so different. And I love the Heartbreakers. Obviously, I wouldn't have done a whole episode if I didn't. But it was really cool that it was so different than his album Full Moon Fever from 1989. And so different from Wildflowers from 94. You know, it doesn't have any huge hits such as Running Down a Dream, Free Fallin', or You Don't Know How It Feels. But it has great songwriting and great storytelling. Like, it really, some of the songs do feel country, even though they really aren't, but they kind of have that feel in the style, the way he does his lyrics. And I mean, I guess he's kind of always had that on some songs, but I don't know, it really shines on this album. It starts great with a song like Saving Grace, which is actually, unless I change my mind between now and when this comes out, it will be the opening song to this episode. So if you like the song that opened this episode, that's Saving Grace by Tom Petty.
Great song.
Yeah, it's
great opener.
Very, yeah, oh my gosh. Yeah, I'd forgotten how awesome that song was. I was skipping to some of the other ones that stay stuck in my head from this album. And I kind of overlooked that one sometimes. And I was just like trying to figure out a song that gets to a great groove very quickly. That just became the no-brainer. But the first song I ever heard off this album was Square One. It was on the Elizabethtown soundtrack, and I fell in love with it. It's just a little acoustic song, but it's so powerful and emotional, I think. I know you love Elizabeth Town soundtrack too, right?
Oh, yes. Always have.
Yeah. Yep. So that's when I first heard of that song, and then later I was able to listen to this album by getting a hold of it through Greg, like I borrowed his copy. But let's see. I have a few more notes, or maybe I don't have more notes on this. Okay. Song. Oh man, like I like every song on this album, I'm just realizing. Flirting with Time is great. Down South is great. The lyrics to that one are fun to me too. I think that's the one that he also is poetic and everything, even like references Samuel Clemens, I think, at some point.
Or yes, Clemens. Samuel Clemens, yep.
Yeah.
A.K.A. Mark Twain.
Yeah. I want to call him Tom Sawyer, one of his characters.
You're thinking of today's Tom Sawyer. Mean pride.
But also the song Jack is just a fun little song. Yep. Turn This Car Around.
Oh, I love that one.
Yeah, it's got a very like slow grind feel to it. And I don't mean grind in a bad way. Like, it's more slow moving than a lot of his stuff, but it's so worth it. Then it goes to really energetic with Turn This Car Around and Big Weekend. Got some really big guitar riffs on that at times. And I'm sure it's Mike Campbell. I know he always helps him out from the Heartbreakers. But I don't know, like, in the Heartbreakers, there's always like this driving bass line that is, it's just a bass guitar fill and drums that for like every Heartbreaker album. This does not have that. And where, like I said, I love it in the Heartbreakers. It was fun to have that different feel. Damaged by Love. It's kind of a depressing but sweet song. I love it. Night Driver. I mean, I'm just naming every track on this. It's really good. Like, I really couldn't just narrow down just two tracks to talk about or three tracks. I just love it. And I really do think it's overlooked because, like, it doesn't have any huge hits like his first two ones did. But it is one that I mainly listen to on road trips. And I always am glad I choose it whenever I, you know, put it in for road trips.
Yeah, it's appropriate. That's what I was going to say. My main contribution here is it's appropriate that this album is called Highway Companion, is it not?
Oh, of course.
Because it really is a highway companion for you. It's a song. I remember getting this album when I was working for the school newspaper in college, the Tripolitan at Troy University. Cheap plug there. And I remember getting this album when I was there, and I may have even written a review in the paper, but it was it blew me away. It really blew me away, and for many reasons. But the fact that this was a solo record by Tom Petty that has so many great rockin' tunes. I remember this was my soundtrack to so many road trips towards my last year or two of college, and in particular, Saving Grace, Square One is a great song. Square One, my slate is clear. You know that whole deal. All the songs that you've mentioned, it adds up to this beautiful road trip experience, and especially a road trip experience if you're at a time in your life that I find myself in a lot, where you're not really sure where you're going, where you're not really sure what your place in life is. It's just a nice reflective kind of album to put on, and whether you're letting loose and having fun with Saving Grace, or whether you're being more reflective of a song like Down South, it's just such a terrific album and one of my favorites to this day from Tom Petty.
Yeah, Down South kind of felt like it should have come off of what's that South album he did? Southern Accents. I don't know. It's such a, like I said, I think it belongs because it's such an overlooked album. Like, I never hear it talked about, whereas I hear most of the Heartbreaker albums get talked about, and definitely his first two solo albums get all kinds of talk. But this is one I don't hear much talked about outside of, like, me and you. I mean, I know it's got its fans, but they're not as vocal anyway.
Right.
So what do you have for your next album?
My next album, I'm going to go the exact opposite direction of country music, and I'm going to go into
gangster rap.
Very close. What inspires much of gangster rap, In fact, one of the songs in this album has been sampled numerous times in rap songs. But I'm going to go to the 1970s funk movement, and in particular, the godfather of soul, the godfather of funk, James Brown. And the album that I'm going to is James Brown's soundtrack to the movie Black Caesar, which was a blaxploitation movie that came out in 1973. And this was his first foray into doing a soundtrack, and the sound kind of fits what you would expect a soundtrack for a blaxploitation movie to be, but it manages to soar and establish itself in a way that doesn't get credit for in hindsight. You know, evidently the Village Voice gave the soundtrack a D+ when it came out. And, you know, it's been overlooked historically. However, one reviewer that I read, I agree with, he calls it a kick-ass soundtrack with nothing short of a full frontal funk assault. And that's how I would describe it, a funk assault. Because when I was listening to this album recently, I listened to it because of one song. And one song on this album is one of the most influential funk songs ever recorded, and that's called The Boss. Paid the Cost to Be the Boss, which I think Snoop Dogg used for an album name. It's been sampled countless times in various songs over the years in hip-hop and rap music. But also, it's not just a one-song album. But I want to talk a little bit about that, because it's just, if you listen to that song, The Boss, it is just one of the coolest songs ever recorded by anybody. I would defy anyone to listen to this song and not feel at least 10% cooler than you felt before you started listening to it. It's just like, it's a song that you want to play whenever you enter a building. And that song alone would be enough to get a recommendation, but it's not just that. It's James Brown and his backing band, the JBs, providing just this, to me, a snapshot of time. If you hear this album, there's no other time that this could be except the early 1970s. You instantly think 70s. You instantly think Harlem. You instantly think a movie like, you know, you think of a movie like Shaft or a movie like this movie, Black Caesar. It's that sort of sound, and man, it's so powerful. It's so driving. A song like Down and Out in New York City, which has got the classic funk beat and also has a just soaring James Brown vocal where he comes out with a "Hey!" right out of the gate, you know, that kind of stuff. And it, over and over again, it's hypnotic. It's awesome. And then the there's a song on here called Mama Feel Good, which is actually sung by a lady by the name of Lynn Collins. Who I had never heard before, I don't think, unless I had heard on a radio single and not recognized it. But she is outstanding on this song. James Brown, of course, wrote all the music here and all the songs, and it's that song is a great one. And just in general, you hear there are a couple of tracks here and there, like any soundtrack album. There's a couple tracks that you skip through because they're instrumentals that are designed to sort of fit the feel of the scene that they're written for. It really is written to be watched with the movie. But so many of these, I would be fine just putting this on as atmospheric music. You know, just I did that the other night, actually. I just had this album playing while I was doing chores around the apartment, and it really stands out, man. James Brown he's an artist that I didn't really give enough credit to when I was a kid. I never really understood the appeal until recently, when I've started recognizing, holy crap, James Brown did that song. James Brown did that song. And realizing how much of what he did and his band did laid the groundwork for a lot of the dance music or hip-hop that you might enjoy today. So really, I highly recommend this. As soundtrack albums go, it's really, really strong.
Nice. Now, I have to ask, does it have James Brown's Hot Tub Party on it?
No, but in my research on James Brown, I did uncover, and I can't remember the title of the song now, but I uncovered the song that they would play a sample from whenever Eddie Murphy's James Brown would go into the hot tub.
Too hot in the hot tub.
Yeah, so good, man. Such a great great artist, and this is an album that, you know, this was kind of what I was alluding to before, that this is not one of his best albums. This is not something that would go down as a top five or probably even 10 James Brown album, but it's a really good one. And for a guy that cut that many records, I would definitely put this in the top half that I've heard anyway.
Is he still alive?
No, no. He passed away a few years ago. Well, actually, passed away a decade ago. He passed away in 2006. I was off by a lot. But, yeah. He passed away in 2006, age 73.
Oh, wow. Okay. I didn't realize he was that old when he died. Well, because I didn't realize he was dead. I thought he was, but I wasn't 100% sure. He's one of those artists that I know has influenced a lot of people, and I've appreciated it. It's one of those many bands and artists that I don't think to listen to, but I know I'll probably enjoy if I do. Because you know me, I love a good funk groove, and I know a lot of his stuff was like that.
Oh, yeah, and he had over, like, 50 albums to his name, I think. So, I mean, wow. There's plenty of catalog to go through.
Nice. Well, my next one I'm going to talk about is one that just literally came to me yesterday. It's one that I've thought didn't get a lot of attention when it came out. It might have, but not that I'm aware of. I definitely know whenever I hear this artist talked about, it's mainly for stuff off his first album. But that is an artist, Gary Clark Jr., his second album, Sonny Boy Slim. I wanted to come put it on this on this list because I think it was pretty overlooked because it didn't do exactly what his first album did, which was really show his blues kicks and his ability to. Like, the first album had a bunch of other stuff on there too. It kind of showcases a lot of different styles he can do. But still, what got noticed off that first album were his blues songs. And I know I heard him talk in a recent interview that, like, honestly, why he's to the level of success he has now is because of his live albums. And a lot of that comes down to his jam songs, wherever he'll bring in some old blues licks and parts and mix it in with his own songs. It just seems like because he's such a guitar virtuoso, that's what people expect from him. They don't just expect the more soulful sound of him. And that's what this album did. This album, it felt like I'm not going to say completely avoided blues, but it definitely felt like he did not either feel inspired to do blues on this album as much or really wanted to show, hey, I can do something else. So this one's a lot more soulful. Brings some all kinds of stuff. I can't even think of other than classic R&B sound on these songs. But it's got a lot of good stuff on there, like Stay With Me. It's a good kind of soulful song. I'm butchering some of the names, but there's some other good songs on there. Grinder, Hold On, Cold Blooded. All those are great. But I don't know. This album, it's never going to be When the Train Comes In, like off his first album. Like, that is the one I think everybody thinks of, that and a couple others. But it's so strong. And actually, you'll probably hear a snippet from the song Shake, which is just like an old nitty-gritty blues song. Probably mm-hmm. is going to be my middle song right before this comes back from a break. This album is one I listened to when it came out. I liked it, but then I kind of put it aside because I think it wasn't what I expected. But after listening to the new one, I wanted to go back to his other stuff and kind of give all of it a listen. And I'd appreciate it more. There's a good song on here. Our Love is really good too. So yeah, pretty much so much on this is good.
It's interesting, David, because you put this on there because I remember when I haven't listened to it, I don't think, or at least I haven't listened to it in a while. But I remember when it came out, you weren't a huge fan of it, right?
No, not at the time. But then, like, probably a year or so later, it became an album I would throw on and sing along with because mm-hmm. I found some recordings of me adding some extra harmony and some hype man moments into some of the songs. So it's kind of one that's grown on me over time. It wasn't as straightforward rock as the first one. And like I say, the first one, Black and Blue, to be fair, has a lot of other stuff on there. And I know the one that won a Grammy off his first album wasn't all bluesy. It was, Please Come Home, I want to say, which is falsetto singing. So anyway, yeah, he's a very impressive artist, and like I said, even myself, I kind of overlooked this album when it came out. I bought it the day it came out, listened to it, but it just kind of took a little while to grow on me, but I now appreciate it a lot more. I think because I can kind of hear some of its influence on the new album, because the new album, he did even more of the same with, not say more of the same, more of the, I'm showing you I can do all kinds of stuff. There's definitely some blues songs on it, but I know an interview I heard him talk about that wasn't even like what he originally imagined. Like he did, like, I want to say some like punk music at some points in bands. He did like a kind of Boys to Men kind of thing some point in his childhood. Like he didn't really know musically where he was going to go originally. He kind of got in on the blues thing just because of that's what got him noticed, and that's what got him invited out on tour. So he loves all styles of music, and it was just kind of funny to hear even today him talk about how he didn't want to just be pigeonholed that way, but that because of his live albums, that's kind of how he's continued to sustain interest in everything. Because he's had two live albums already, and had three full-length albums and then two live albums already.
Well, he seems like a guy that it would be worth checking out his live show for sure.
Oh, I've got to one of these days. So you say you didn't listen to this one, right?
No, if I did, it's been so long that I can't remember it.
Okay. Well, I think right now would be a good time to take a quick break. And when we come back, we'll have three more albums each and let you know what's going on the pop feed and the wrestling feed.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Place to Be Nation's JT Rosero and Chad Campbell here. We want to let you know that we have over 24 podcasts available on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlaceToBeNation.com. We now offer them to you on two great feeds. The Place to Be Nation Wrestling feed. We dive into topics running the gamut from today's WWE to the glory days of yesteryear and the ins and outs of the territory days. In addition to our full-length shows, we also deliver to you special pod blasts on topics old and new.
The Place to Be Nation Pop feed is a veritable treasure trove of great content. Offer tremendous shows covering the land of movies, television, life, comics, and sports, brought to you by the most knowledgeable and insightful folks in the podcast world.
You can find all these great shows, plus archives of our past podcasts from over the past 8 years as well, by subscribing to both feeds on iTunes. And while you're there, be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. All of these shows, plus others, available on PlaceToBeNation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus in-depth search projects, and much more. Be sure to support our site by using www.PlaceToBeNation.com/Amazon when doing your online shopping. We want to thank our friends at Boneheads, Wing Bar, ProWrestlingOnly.com, and TheHistoryOfWrestling.com as well. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr. PlaceToBeNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
And we're back for the second half of Sunday Groove. Greg is still here with me. But first, before we get back to the episode, we're going to talk about what's going on the website. We've had a busy week on the pop feed with something for everyone. Russell and Sam dish about the classic Empire Records in a new 90s to nothing. That is actually one that I started listening to, but because I'd forgotten so much about the movie, I had to go back and listen. Wanted to rewatch the movie because I was like hearing him talk about stuff, and I'm like, I don't remember that character, and I don't really remember it that well. So it's kind of one of those that I paused and went back to the movie. So I recommend that. Definitely wouldn't get as much out of it if you had not familiar with the movie.
All I have been reminded of about that movie is Liv Tyler.
Oh my goodness, dude, Renee Zellweger too. There's a scene in there. That she's only wearing a apron and some panties. And I was like, wow, okay. I normally don't. I mean, I find her cute, but, you know, she's no Liv Tyler. But that movie, she's definitely peak. Man, now I just want to watch the crazy music video over and over again by Aerosmith. Because, man, that and Alicia Silverstone. who is not in Empire Records, but should be.
And who can forget about Anthony LaPaglia? The legend himself.
Or Ethan Embry. Woo! That's a handsome feller.
Oh. He was such an icon of pop culture for a very brief period of time.
Yes, I'd forgotten about him actually until their episode a few months back when they did Can't Hardly Wait, and I was just like, man, he really was in everything, because he was in That Thing You Do, and he was in this, and anyway. So then we got this month's Talkin' Pop with Jenny and Tim. They welcome in JT Rosero to relive the magic of WrestleMania weekend in New York City.
That's I got one. The pace.
Thank you for getting that reference. That's the only reason why I did that voice. Then we got Ben Morse and Russell Sellers, where they talk the first half of 1970 in a new Marvel Age masterclass. I will be getting to that soon. Hopefully I'm catching up on Marvel Age right now. Then we got Adam and Andrew. They deliver an in-depth playoff previews on a dual offering of the NBA Team podcast. And I get winded, so that's why there was that weird pause there. Anybody that knows me in personal life knows that I do that in real life as well. I probably do it on my podcast and don't notice it most of the time. But yes, I don't know when to take a breath. Then we got Todd Weber and Tim Capel as they look at the Uncanny X-Men number 136, plus much more in a latest episode of Conversation Comics. That's a fun show that if you've never listened to it, be prepared to hear a lot of stuff that is about comics and a lot of stuff that's kind of all over the place. They have some very interesting conversations that go off the rails in all the perfect ways.
Absolutely. Totally agreed.
Then we have the Hard Shoving Fanboys, where they had reviewed Shazam, but since then, there's also been another Hard Shoving Fanboys episode drop. And remind me what that was on, Greg. I know it just came out, I think, yesterday.
Yes, we were joined. I'm getting all my weeks confused.
Oh, the Shazam,
now. The
TV show, right? No.
Yeah, that's next week.
That's right. Yeah, recorded that, but y'all hadn't come out.
Recorded that, but haven't dropped. Yeah, this one
Jeff
was about
Parker, right? Jeff
yeah,
Parker, right?
No, actually, this one was about the Power of Shazam by Jerry Ordway.
Jerry Ordway, I don't know why. Was that the one about Jeff Parker?
Jeff Parker did the not Jeff Parker. Jeff Smith did the Shazam, the Monster Society of Evil, which you can find also in the archives from earlier this month. But yes, this one, the most recent one that's currently up on the feed as we record this, is a review of the Power of Shazam, a 1994 graphic novel from writer artist Jerry Ordway. However, by the time you hear this, you will probably also have the conclusion to Shazam Month, which is we were joined by the manager, Todd Weber, to look at the very unique 1970s Shazam TV show, which is currently available to watch on the DC Universe app. And this is one of the most spectacularly bad things that we have reviewed on HTF. But it was so bad that we actually, instead of watching one episode, I ended up watching four episodes. It was just, it was hypnotic in a way of how hilarious the show was. So we have a review of that. And then I don't know exactly when this is going to drop. The month of May is going to start Avengers Month for us. Obviously, David, you and I are going to be involved in a big Avengers Endgame viewing session here in the near future. And we at the HTF are going to have our own review of that movie. Plus, we're going to kick off an entire month dedicated to Earth's Mightiest Heroes, the Avengers. We'll be tackling comic books, video games, TV series, everything Avengers. So be on the lookout for that.
Nice. Yes, I should have said at the beginning of this live read, my show, I don't know when it's coming out. We were recording on the 21st, but I don't know how busy the Pop Network is this week, so I don't know when it will air. But so yes, I'm glad Greg filled in when some of the others that might come out before then. Then we got Cowboy and D'Amato are back in the saddle with a new This Week in Sports, and I scrolled too far over. Catch us up on everything since the Super Bowl. So is that everything in life or just everything in sports, I guess?
Knowing D'Amato, not that I know him super well, I'm assuming this is going to be everything in life. And probably some things in life we weren't prepared to hear.
If it's like his Talking Pop episode, yes, definitely some stuff I wasn't prepared to hear. Now, I loved it on there. It was just...
Yeah, he's great.
Yes. then we got Todd welcomed JT to Binge Please as they talked Netflix, Marvel Universe, and Daredevil Season 1. And listen to that. I just really... It made me want to go back and continue my rewatch of the early Netflix Daredevil and Jessica Jones stuff, because the later stuff, I like some of it and some of it I don't. So, like, I don't know, it just kind of was reminding me of stuff from the first couple seasons of those shows that I loved. Mainly the first season of Daredevil and the first season of Jessica Jones. Because JT had watched a lot of them in a very compact, compressed time frame, so that we were all just kind of running together in his head. And so, anyway, very enjoyable show. And then we got Todd also on, he's joining Andy to talk Swingers in the third episode of Laughing Theater. And a new contest is being held over on Looking Forward, Looking Back. They'll be doing a summer movie wager based on how well you think you can predict how well the summer's movies will do at the domestic box office. What you need to do is pick the top 10 movies in order of how you think they will finish in domestic box office gross. You will also need to include 3 wildcard picks, as well as which movie you think will be the biggest bomb of the summer. And imagine they mean bomb is not doing well, not da bomb, you know, the kids in the 90s or whenever that was said.
Yes, yes, when we were kids in the 90s. And yeah, that's what it means. I made a selection on that, but I'm terrified. I didn't pick this movie, but I'm terrified that Dark Phoenix could end up being a box office bomb. We'll have to see.
That's going to break my heart if it is, because I know like none of our friends are excited about it. I am, but that's also because I have very little knowledge of the like, I mean, I know about it. Don't get me wrong. I've heard about the Dark Phoenix saga that Todd and Tim are talking about right now on Conversation Comics. But like, outside of that, like, I don't have a lot invested in it. I know The Last Stand was bad as a whole, even though I still like the first like 45 minutes of it. I like this cast of the X-Men, so I'm excited for it.
I'm actually probably of our friend. It's weird that I'm not more excited for this, because I actually liked Apocalypse. I'm pretty much one of the few people I know that actually liked Apocalypse. I'm much higher on the X-Men movies in general than a lot of our friends group is, but I don't know, something about this one's just, it's got me worried, and I hope that they can pull it off, because I actually enjoyed it. I don't think Apocalypse is great, and it probably is not going to hold up to multiple rewatches. But I liked it in the theater, and I really liked Days of Future Past, so I'm hoping they can pull off a good movie here.
Yeah, First Class and Days of Future Past were both incredible. I liked them both a lot. Days is the stronger of the two, but still. Apocalypse has a lot of fun moments, and the deleted, or might be just extended in the deleted scenes, but the mall scene that got cut from the movie is so much fun, of just like the new X-Men that joined up. Going and just having fun at the mall, and just, of course, hijinks happen. That totally should have been the movie.
I've got to watch that version. Yeah. I've got to watch that version. That and the road cut of Days of Future Past I've never seen. So.
Yes, I still need to see that too. You can borrow my copy of Apocalypse. That scene's in there. I very much appreciated that scene and thought it should have been there, because I felt like towards the end it just kind of got into the superhero kind of bunch of stuff happening and just kind of all over the place CGI, where it looked fine, but it just, I don't know, it didn't stand out to me the same, but I'm excited for it. I've been an X-Men mark for quite some time. So anyway, so to finish up on that, yeah, you send your picks to Looking Forward, Looking Back, LFLBpop @gmail.com by Monday, April 22nd. So actually, you won't get a chance to do that. Never mind, I did not realize that. Okay, but that will be taking place. Any movie that is released after April 26th is eligible for the tally and then on Labor Day. So anyway, that's going to be going on. If you haven't taken part in it, at least maybe you can access it and enjoy it.
And follow along.
Yes. Greg, do you mind about the wrestling feed a little bit?
Absolutely not. Nothing brings me more pleasure in life than talking about wrestling, and other than watching wrestling. So in the premiere episode of... And I should mention, this is over on the PTBN Wrestling feed, of course. In the premiere episode of Making Towns with Friends, Steve and Rich explore what could have been if a Money in the Bank match had occurred at every WrestleMania since inception. In other words, what if a Money in the Bank match had occurred at every WrestleMania match since inception? Not the movie Inception, since the first WrestleMania. Interesting concept here. We'll see what they can pull out with there. I'm predicting a bunch of wins for Big John Studd. JT and Scott were joined by Todd Weber for episode number 517 of the Mothership, the Place to Be podcast, and they broke down the March 1989 MSG House Show. This is Madison Square Garden. This is not what you might find in your Chinese food.
I was about to say, I thought MSG was a bad thing.
No, not in this case. In wrestling, it's a good thing, unless you're talking about 1989 house shows, typically. those can be bad things. JT and Chad return with a new wrestling war zone as they finish off 1995, not with a whimper, but with a bang, talking about Starrcade 95, which was WCW versus New Japan Pro Wrestling in a tournament of sorts. So check out our social media pages and the message board at www.bigelow34@proboards.com for information on joining our greatest WWE wrestler ever PPV and TV match project. So we're trying to find the greatest pay-per-view and television wrestling matches in the history of WWE. For those of you that aren't wrestling fans, don't bother. But if you did watch wrestling when you were a kid or remember a lot of wrestling matches from when you were growing up, take part. It's a fun project. Join over at the message board, bigelow34.proboards.com. Get in on the conversation and maybe revisit some of the classic matches from your youth that you remember watching. And be sure to check out placetobenation.com as things are getting back up and running there with plenty of projects and reviews to come. Content will be picking back up in the days and weeks ahead. And just to give folks a little heads up, Nick and I have another What If Wrestling already recorded in the can, and we have several other planned to record in the coming weeks. So look for those.
Nice. Thanks for picking that up for me. I need to read next time off, not off of my phone. I'm going to have to actually have it on a different device because I was straining my eyes. Because if I had read all of it previously, I read a lot of it, but I did not notice that April 22nd cutoff, which is tomorrow. So I would have not read that whole paragraph. But that's okay. Like I said, I think that's a fun contest.
Now they have extra information about the contest.
Right. So. Well, that is true. That is true. Yeah, earlier when you were mentioning the contest, I thought you were talking about the candy tournament that I know was just ended today. But
candy cane.
Also, I've noticed how I say tournament and how Andy Atherton and a lot of other people probably correctly say tournament. So that's been something.
How do you say tournament?
I say it probably incorrectly, but tournament. Is it more of tournament or not tournament? That's butchered. But
I always say tournament. I mean that's just partly probably because we're in the South, but
right. I think
properly it would be tournament,
right?
Tournament,
to say the second time, and I
tournament's fine. Tournament is how most people say it. So
yeah, and speaking of things like tournaments, turnips they're pretty good sometimes.
Turnips can be good. Turnips are good if you cook them the right way.
Right.
For those of you that don't live in the South, we got all kinds of greens. We got turnip greens, mustard greens.
Why did you turn into Forrest Gump? Does he have a thing about that?
Yeah, I don't know. It's just something we have a lot of down here, greens. And they're good, and they're good. We hear on to give people a little insider information, I actually work for a university, which I've already named on this podcast. And on Thursdays at our faculty and staff dining hall, we actually have turnip greens that are served. And they're very good. They're very, very high quality turnip greens. So if you're ever in the Troy, Alabama area, just hit me up and I'll treat you to a meal up at the faculty and staff dining. Unless I suspect you of being a serial killer, in which I will not do such a thing.
And speaking of other veggie things, I think you're not a fan. I like rutabagas if they're seasoned right.
I don't like rutabagas just from the jump because of the name.
Right.
I want to say rutabeggers so bad.
Yes.
They are.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah, and if they're seasoned right, like with a little bit of sweetness in there and then some good old fattening meat in there with it, like, you know, some kind of pork, it's really, really tasty. I'd never really cared much for them until I had them at a good old Southern cooking place, and I'm now hooked on them.
I'm hooked on a feeling.
I was about to make that reference, so I'm glad our brains think similarly. Or it could mean they were about to have a stroke. I'm not really sure. But anyway, I guess we should get back to our Hidden Gems conversation.
Sure.
So what would be your third one?
Well, for my third selection on Hidden Gems, I'm going to yet another different style of music. And I'm going to one of the all-time great artists. I'm going to Paul McCartney, the legendary Paul McCartney.
I think I've heard of him.
Yes, he was one of the members of Wings. Perhaps you've heard of Wings. That's probably what he's best known for, I think.
I've only heard of Thangs and Wangs.
Well, that they probably got their name from McCartney's most famous band, Wings, which he founded in the 70s. And he also has a very long and lucrative and productive solo career with clearly they can be counted, but I don't have the number of solo albums. In addition, of course, being cheeky, to his work with the Beatles.
Right.
You know, you think of the classic McCartney albums, I think people might think about his solo debut, McCartney. People might think of Ram. People might think of some of his Wings album. Of course, Band on the Run, probably his most famous record post-Beatles. But one that I think people kind of sleep on how good his modern output has been, with particularly his last couple records have been outstanding, Egypt Station and New. But the one that I'm drawing on today is another that I feel gets overlooked when people are looking at the canon of his great solo output. Because I would put this one up there with the best of his solo records, maybe right behind McCartney and New. And that this is a record called Chaos and Creation in the Backyard.
Ooh, okay.
This came out in 2005. And marked a little bit of a departure for Paul, because this was a record that was produced by Nigel Godrick, who is a guy that has been a producer for Radiohead and Beck. And Paul, ever since pretty much he had started, had produced his own albums. You know, I think George Martin produced a couple of his solo albums. But Paul, for the most part, is notorious for wanting control over his own music. So
right.
He kind of went to an outside voice to put this record together and help him edit songs and fine-tune these recordings to make the song sound exactly like they needed to sound. And Paul actually credited Godrick for being honest with him. He said it's very rare for him to find a producer that has the courage to tell Paul McCartney when a song's not working. And he was initially kind of taken aback by that, but then he grew to appreciate it, because Paul has always done his best work when he's pushed in some way, whether it was by John Lennon, whether it was by George Martin, whether it was by Elvis Costello in the 80s, whoever it may be that he's collaborating with at a given time. A lot of times he's done his best work in those situations. And so I find that to be the case here, because right off the bat, this album, which came out well over a decade ago, sounds like it could have been released yesterday. No pun intended. And it starts right out of the gates with a rollicking song, Fine Line, which was one that Paul played at the Grammys that year. And it's just a really energetic, upbeat, rocking song to start off the album. But this sounds, you know, I said this about Egypt Station as well, his newest album. It sounds like an album that he might have recorded around the time of the Beatles, or right coming out of the Beatles, when he was sort of at his creative peak, because you've got a song like Fine Line, and then a song like How Kind of You, which is kind of a ballad of sorts, and totally different, but a beautiful ballad at that. Then he goes from there to Jenny Wren, which is kind of along the lines of Eleanor Rigby, of this really sad sort of story about this heartbroken woman. And Jenny Wren, probably one of the best songs he's ever written, at least as a solo artist. Then he goes from there to At the Mercy, which sounds like a contemporaneous pop song, but something that maybe could have sprung from the Beatles if the Beatles were still recording music today, through the lens of what was then going on with Europop and things of that nature. Something like, it almost sounds like a Coldplay song at times.
And I don't, cool.
Yeah, and I don't mean that as an insult like a lot of people would with Coldplay. I think that's a good thing.
Right.
So Friends to Go is one of the revelations when I was re-listening to this album, because I didn't remember the song at all. And it struck me that, gosh, this sounds familiar to me, but not like, it doesn't sound like a specific song. So I read up about the song, and turns out Paul says that he was inspired by George Harrison to write this song, and that he felt like George had actually inhabited him writing this song. So it really does sound like a George Harrison song. Just in terms of the lyrics, the melody, everything, it sounds like a song that George would have written. And the lyrics almost sound like George talking to Paul from beyond the grave. So it is an outstanding song. English Tea sounds like something Paul would have written on Revolver. It's got that sort of classical harpsichord sound kind of going in it, you know? And it sounds like something that would have been written then. Too Much Rain is this another tragic kind of sad ballad about life. And, you know, Riding to Vanity Fair is another song that's that stood out to me on this re-listen. And one thing that all of these songs have in common from top to bottom, first of all, I should mention that Paul plays all the instruments on this record. He does it all. He plays drums. I mean, he's got some help in some songs with some arrangements, some strings and stuff, but he plays piano, electric piano, Baldwin spinet, whatever that is, bass guitar, electric guitar, acoustic, classical guitar, drums, violin, maracas, tambourine, vocals, flugelhorn. That's just to get started. There's a bunch of others listed here. But one of the things that stands out in this is that Paul is the greatest bass player. I mean, the bass is, A, it's mixed really well, and B, the bass lines in these songs are just to die for. They're so good. And this album just sounds so timeless. You can put it in at any moment, whether it was 10 years ago, today, you could have put it in 20 years ago, and it's got this crisp sound. The production quality is so high on it. The songwriting quality is so high on it. The instrumentation is so high on it. And this really kicks off Paul's sort of late career renaissance that he, you know, with New, which came out maybe, what, 5-6 years ago now? And then and that's one that we both loved. And then Egypt Station, which came out last year and was really, really good. So, yeah, this Chaos and Creation, I think if people give it a shot, and it's one that might take time to grow on you, but for me, like, this is one that would stand up against the very best songs, or best albums, I should say, in Paul's catalog.
It's one I listened to several years ago at a recommendation of you and also our friend Corey. He mm-hmm. he likes this album a lot, and or he likes it anyway. And I remember, like, Jenny Wren and English Tea, those sound very familiar to me, but I'm going to have to revisit it. Because I remember liking it, but there's so many albums to go to of his that I still, there's a lot that either I forget about or that I haven't discovered or haven't listened to begin mm-hmm. with. So
I understand that. I've recently started to try to, I haven't really delved into it much, but I want to listen to his Flowers in the Dirt album, to listen to his collaborations with Elvis Costello. But that's from the 80s. So I have not listened to it yet, but that's on my list to delve into. So
nice. Sorry, if you hear any weird sounds, it's me adjusting my headset. It was sliding off my head. I love Paul McCartney, as you know. And so that's just one of those other ones I need to go back to, apparently. Because I know it, like I said, I know I listened to it, but it's just not as familiar. So I couldn't pick something any different from Greg's, and that wasn't the intention. It was one that I thought about mainly because of one song, but when I went back and listened to the whole thing, I really appreciate this even more. And that is Weird Al Yankovic, his album from 2014, Mandatory Fun. And one thing I remember about this album in particular was he released, like, I think a new music video every day for the week it came out. So, like, he had really good marketing around it, because I think he knows that his little niche of music, things might not do as well in modern days as it was back in the 90s, as far as sales and stuff like that. So he found out a way to make it stick in your head and kind of keep him in your mind. And this album, it's him doing a lot of parodies, but also he's got some really cool originals that are style parodies that he likes to do. People love to say he only does parodies, but he does what he calls style parodies as well, where it's completely original song, but he just kind of picks a band he likes and kind of does something that could sound like they could have written it, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
So it's got starts off with the song "Handy," which was a parody of "Fancy" by Iggy Azalea, and it's fun because I don't know, Weird Al. Like, I know he gets crap for being the parody guy and also just doing things about food, but this one he researches topics and finds all kinds of different clever ways to talk about things. So, like, on "Handy," he talks about all the things he can fix in the house, but like, uses some interesting lingo, so I kind of appreciated that. Then his first poking at fun of the internet culture, lame claim to fame, sorry, not fame. He just talks about all the people that just try to like advertise like the most ridiculous, inane thing that could be their tie to something famous, and like that they're bragging about it, and I find it very funny. To his parody of Royals by Lord, called Foil. And this one starts off about using foil in the kitchen. And it continues on and talks about all kinds of stuff involving paranoia and all kinds of stuff. And it just kind of devolves into something completely different. And I love it for that, because it just shows that, yes, he can talk about more than just food and talk about a variety of things. And I like that sometimes you don't see the later humor coming. Like, some things you do, but a lot you don't. Then Word Crimes, which was his parody of Blurred Lines, the very controversial song that got played a lot. And, of course, they had to pay a lot of money to Marvin Gaye, I believe it was.
Mm-hmm.
That was Robin Thicke and T.I. and Pharrell Williams. But anyway, Word Crimes goes a very different way. You got to watch the music video. It's a better way to appreciate the song. He decides to do a grammar lesson. And he basically makes fun of people or of the patterns of incorrect grammar and stuff on the internet. And it's just, I don't know, it could have been something so different. There's so many different ways he could have gone with that parody, but I thought it was very intellectual the way he did that.
Mm-hmm.
You would definitely appreciate it, being a journalism major. All your English background and stuff, you would appreciate a lot of the stuff. So definitely check that out. Of course, I always enjoy the Polka compilations, because he does a good job just picking random different things. In particular, I like he put in there, what is it, Gangnam Style. He just did some really fun kind of, I don't want to call it commentary, but anyway, some interesting stuff in there. And there was one song talked about standing up and shouting, and he did like a sheer scream. I don't know. It's funny in execution, not in describing it.
At least he didn't have a sheer heart attack.
Thankfully, no. And let's see. Mission statement includes all kinds of different random jargon you'll hear at certain companies. That means mostly nothing. including Synergy and stuff like that. Inactive, cover of Radioactive, or parody of Radioactive by Imagine Dragons, was really fun, just making fun of people, or not making fun of people, but just having fun about not, you know, having a sedentary life. And then finally, he did Tacky, which most people probably heard. That was his parody of Happy by Pharrell Williams. But my reason for being here, after I've uttered all those many, many words, the final song, it says it's a style parody of Cat Stevens, but it is a song called Jackson Park Express. It is a song about meeting someone on mass transit and then developing a story inside your head and misreading all kinds of social cues. And it is so dramatic, and it goes on and on and on and gets creepier and creepier and creepier. But it's incredible. Like, I'll put it up against most of any of his other stuff. Like, I really adore that song because it's so bizarre and funny that I think anybody should check it out. A lot of clever wordplay and stuff in it. I was gonna bring up the lyrics, but I'm trying not to go so long-winded. So anyway, if you're ever bored, listen to that song. Or if you ever just need to laugh, listen to that song or read the lyrics at least. It is worth your time.
Yeah, I actually remember that song. You played it for me in the car going to visit Russell one weekend. And I remember hearing it and very much enjoying it. Very, very clever song.
Yes, it's one I made most everybody that was in my friend group, if they were riding in the car with me, I made them check that one out because I thought it was definitely one of his best songs, just because, for one thing, being a socially awkward person, the early parts I can relate to, but then the later stuff, he just is being Weird Al. He goes some very weird places. So I think just musically too, it's just a good song. He's a very talented musician. So, I think we were actually going to, I think it was when Empire Comics might have still been open. So we were, might've been going there as well. But anyway, maybe it was Garner I made listen to it that time, but whatever. So what is your next album?
My next album, I'm going back to country music, and I'm going to a guy that was a favorite of mine when I was a kid, and I thought just disappeared off the face of the map in terms of music making anyway, only to discover that some of his recent albums are among the best that he's done. And this is a guy who's also in a great movie called Sling Blade, and his name is Dwight Yoakam.
Yes!
And the album, I kind of cheated on here because I actually had two albums that were back-to-back albums that he did that separated by 3 years, I think. The first one was Three Pairs, and the second one, which is the one I'm really going to focus on in this episode, is called Secondhand Heart. So Three Pairs came out in 2012, and was voted by a lot of critics the top country music album of that year. It was number 18 on the Billboard 200 chart, his highest ranking album on a general music chart, which is amazing because nobody I know had ever even heard of this album. It also appeared on more best of lists from critics than any album in the country music genre. So I'm going to ignore that one for now. It's a great record. Go check it out. I only discovered it through the joy of Spotify's shuffle playlists, and one of the songs caught my ear, and I ended up listening to the whole album, and it's terrific from top to bottom. It also includes collaborations with Beck, Kid Rock, and Ashley Monroe of Pistol Annies. I don't know who they are, but
I've heard their name a lot, but I don't hard to say.
Apparently,
a lot.
Miranda Lambert is part of the Pistol Annies.
Ooh.
So,
she's quite an attractive female.
She is, and she has a great voice.
No, ma'am, she's got a great voice. I just,
but yes, and Beck is the producer actually on this album, along with Dwight Yoakam. So that's a great album. But the one that I'm focusing on is called Secondhand Heart, and this came out in 2015 to show you the level of kind of overlooked that it is. It doesn't even have much information on its Wikipedia summary. All it has is track listing, personnel, and how many copies it sold, which the total is 87,000 copies that it sold, which is not, like, amazing. So
no, definitely not as established as he is.
But the thing is, the one thing that's clear in Dwight Yoakam's kind of advanced part of his career is he's doing the kind of music that he wants to do. He's not... Again, as I mentioned with Jamie Johnson, Dwight is not sort of adapting to the times. He's not changing with the times. He's not changing his sound to fit what's on the radio right now. He's doing what he's always done. He's making country music that he wants to make, hillbilly music, rockabilly-themed music, and even a little bit of sort of a punk country kind of vibe to a lot of these songs. In Secondhand Heart, that's one of the things that struck me was the production on this one. It sounds, and it's recorded it sounds almost like a punk rock approach to country in that it's very stripped down instrumentation. Sounds like a lot of guitar, bass, drums. You know, occasionally you'll get something like a harmonica or a mandolin thrown in, but very much this is a stripped down, live sounding album. Very much the same approach to a lot of the early punk records. So it sounds like it could be recorded in the 50s or something, but it doesn't sound like he's recording 50 standards. These are well-written songs. These are at times funny songs, at times heartbreaking songs, at times just aggressive songs, and they rock and they stay true to the roots of country music. He's a great songwriter. It's obvious he's a great songwriter, and the backing band that he has here is spectacular as well. Some of the songs that stand out here: In Another World, which is the opener, is a good, really good song. She is another good song. Secondhand Heart, the title track, probably the best song on the album for my money. That's actually probably one of my favorite Dwight Yoakam songs of all time. I love this tune. I've been listening to it for a few years now. And he does a cover of Man of Constant Sorrow that I guarantee is a different version of this song than you've ever heard before.
Who did that originally?
That's a traditional song. That's actually the one that you would know is probably from O Brother, Where Art Thou?
Oh, okay. Yeah, that. Yeah.
So, and he does a song called Liar, which is outstanding. This whole album, top to bottom, there's not a weak track. I listened to the whole thing today and really enjoyed it again. And it's one that flies under the radar for an artist who, when people think about his hits, they think about the 80s and the 90s. And so you think about probably his most famous album is Guitars, Cadillacs, etc., which was, I think, his debut album, if I'm not mistaken.
That was a song, as soon as you mentioned his name, that came in mind, was Guitars and Cadillacs. I can't do his voice. But
That was pretty close. No,
not at all.
But yeah, so, and that's probably his most famous album. But of course, he had some huge hits in the 90s as well. But he kind of disappeared from the public eye, by and large. And I think this is a record that deserved to get him back on the country charts in a big way. And, you know, it's one that I hope maybe if anybody's listening to this podcast that is a country music fan, or even if you're not a country music fan, but if you're just a fan of kind of roots music, maybe give this a shot and see what you think about it, because he can rock too. So this is my selection, my number two hidden gem here, Secondhand Heart by Dwight Yoakam.
Now, I've got to ask you, because I know you take such great pride in it, do you want to give the listeners a taste of your Dwight Yoakam voice?
Gosh, let me see. Let me see if I can strum it up here. Oh, God, that was horrible.
It's not like you were going to yodel there.
It almost turned into that. Yeah, hang on a second. Listen. Guitars and Cadillacs, hillbilly music. Not great. Not great, but the best I can do right now, I think.
That's not bad. Much better than mine, which doesn't say much, but no, guys, I was with Greg when he first discovered his Dwight Yoakam voice, and he literally did it for the next 2 or 3 hours that night.
Yes, this was like 2006 or 7. I remember it was a eureka moment. I had my digital audio recorder with me. Anybody that knows me knows that I fancy myself an amateur impressionist. So I had my little digital recorder with me, and I was so shocked that I got – Dwight Yoakam was a voice – I never could do when I was a kid I would always try it when I was young and I could never get it. And I nailed the Dwight Yoakam voice. And so I recorded myself this night doing it, because I remember telling David, if I don't record it, I'll probably never get it back again. To my surprise, I think I've kept a pretty good one over the years, despite my performance on this show. But I think my Dwight impression is not bad at all. But it's amazing. It was like this moment where I finally got it. I got the vocal tics that I had never gotten before. It's sort of like when you realize that the key to a Hulk Hogan impression is the "ew" at the very beginning. Once you realize that, it opens the door to the impression in a big way.
Nice. Yeah, I need to check this out, because I remember some of his big hits back in the day, but outside of that, I don't think I've ever listened to much of his stuff. But to say a name, I remember being shocked when we were together at a restaurant, Santa Fe, and they played a Joe Diffie song several months ago, and I went down a Joe Diffie trend for a little while there. I have some of his stuff on my phone, and was shocked how many of the songs I actually knew and liked. I know the very different style of country, you know, Dwight says. I was just one of those things that, like, it's fun to go back to and discover stuff. So I tell you, we are very different on this episode, which is quite all right. My next one continues the trend that I was not trying to do with this list and being a lot of modern albums or albums from the last 15 years or so. And that is an album from 2006 by Audioslave.
Yeah.
And that is the album Revelations.
Mm-hmm.
And I will say, I think this album sold very well, but I think it was quickly forgotten because they broke up not long after this album. For whatever reason, I don't know how they held it together to write this cohesive album, because it was definitely one that they found their sound, even the best of their three. I still think maybe their first or second or might be their best album, but this, they found their sound, like really found a way to differentiate themselves from Rage Against the Machines and Soundgarden. Outside of two songs that kind of sound a little Soundgarden-y on this album, most of it is some of the best stuff they wrote. And they did it, but I think because they broke up not long later because of creative differences, people just seem to forget about it. And, and no, it didn't spawn the hits that the first or second one did, but it was really, really good.
And no live performances for the most part of any of these songs.
Yeah.
That I'm aware of. So.
I can't remember.
Maybe he's done. I mean, I'm sure Chris Cornell did some solo tours and stuff, but I don't believe they ever, as a band, at least that I found on YouTube, played most of these songs live. So something like Moth, which is a great song. There's so many great songs on this record, but like Moth or Nothing Left to Say But Goodbye or something like that. We never got to hear them played in person, so I think a lot of people let that album kind of slip by the wayside.
Right. Yeah, like the only thing off this album that kind of gave it more recognition was for the people that saw the Miami Vice movie, there were at least two songs off the album on it, on the soundtrack, and it was so perfect for those scenes too. It was so atmospheric and rocking. But this album like delves a little bit into retro rock, which is something they normally don't do, but it's kind of got like a little funk feel more than, I mean, I know Rage had some funk in it, but this seems even more to bring in some 70s kind of funk with it. And I don't know, between Moth, Wide Awake.
Oh, so good. Sound of a Gun.
Yeah. Sound of a Gun's incredible. The opening part of One and the Same is awesome too. It's a good song, but like that opening is energetic and incredible.
Wow. Yeah.
It was one of the contenders for the opening of this episode, but I decided to go a little different route. But yeah, I re-listened to this multiple times yesterday, and so it was a very last-minute inclusion on this list. But I just adore this album. I adore Chris Cornell. He is such a tremendous loss, losing him at such a young age. I will probably, spoiler alert, talk much more about him in the future, because I know my first episode was dedicated to him and Chester after their unfortunate deaths, but there's just so much incredible stuff out there that it's great to go back and listen to. And Chris, one of the best voices out there.
One song on this album I want to draw some attention to is Jewel of the Summertime, which is another one that always stands out to me. Shape of Things to Come, another one that I think was played in Miami Vice.
I think
that has a great groove to it. And of course, even the title track, Revelations, which I think probably got the most play due to it was on the Madden soundtrack that year. And it has that kind of bass groove going to it, that this, the bass line of a doom 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 doom.
Oh yeah,
doom 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 doom. Yeah, so very catchy, very catchy album all around. I love this record so much. I remember when it came out, David, we were so excited to hear the music from it. Do you remember when we kept clicking on their, was it their MySpace page or their website?
Yes, and every time you went onto it, it would play Original Fire. So it would be, "The Original Fire, the Original Fire." And I know that's more of a Barry Gibb singing it, but...
No, I want a Barry Gibb cover version of this album. But yeah, so we'd hear the same, and it wasn't the song, it was just the same beginning clip of that song.
Right, it ruined that song for a while for me.
And over again.
Yeah.
And so we thought, I ended up hating that song at first.
Yes.
And then in hindsight now, I actually like that song, but it took me years to like that song.
Yes, we would just keep going back for different things, and it always auto just like a 5 second part of it or something, maybe 10 seconds, and it ruined the song for a while. I'm glad you remembered that, because I was going to reference it anyway. But yeah, it looks like the only two singles that came from it was Original Fire and Revelations. So yeah, it's and oh, one last thing I have to say about it is one of my favorites. Not even songs, but like rhythm section. They have one of the best rhythm sections.
Yes.
I was reminded when I watched Sound City, seeing them collaborate with Dave Grohl, the bassist and the drummer. I'm bad with their names. But they have such a good flow together. And from years of experience with each other, they just feed off each other and can do something so quickly. So, I don't know. Audioslave, if you've never checked them out much, give them a chance. Don't just think the singles are what they are. There's so much there in just three albums. Like a very short time they were together, and definitely one of my favorite supergroups.
Can I give you a? I don't know when the next time is I'm going to do your podcast due to our schedules and everything. So
Right. Let
me give a musical hot take, because I probably won't remember it the next time I am on. This is my musical hot take. This does not reflect the opinion of David Sunday or Place to Be Nation as a whole. This is just Greg Phillips' opinion. I think Audioslave was better than Rage Against the Machine or Soundgarden. There we go. I said it.
Yeah, I can endorse that. I definitely feel that way at times. Like I might prefer their music, but I don't know.
Any hate mail can be tweeted to my Twitter address at JRsBBQ on Twitter.
I will say that one thing I've noticed in recent years is I do like the fact that, yes, there are some... I don't like the fact, but there are some depressing Audioslave songs, but Audioslave isn't as depressing as the most successful Soundgarden stuff, because a lot of the super successful Soundgarden stuff is so depressing. It's weird. They're 80 and pre getting really big stuff was more like super sexual and just weird, like hair metal kind of stuff almost, but their successful stuff was the more depressing stuff. And so I always love Soundgarden, and I love a lot of Rage, but I will say I listen to Audioslave more than both of those bands, or at least more than Rage, for sure. Soundgarden, I did a deep dive back a year and a half ago and kept doing that for a long time. I guess that was just after his death. I kind of thought that was going to be your hot take there. So what is the last album on your list for tonight?
The last album on my list, and again, these were presented in no particular order, but in full disclosure, when I thought about overlooked, underrated albums, this was the one that kind of popped in my mind. Not necessarily underrated by the majority of people, but certainly overlooked in the pantheon of this band, because this is not one of this band's best records. This is not a top three or even four album for this band, but it's still, in my opinion, a great album that it might be the last truly great original album that this band did. And you know I can get through a list, David, without mentioning my favorite band of all time, Led Zeppelin. And the album that I
thought you were going to say Burt Bacharach
and his orchestra.
Yes.
No, they're a close second. They're ahead of the Beatles and the Stones. But I went with Led Zeppelin's 1976 album, Presence.
Oh, my. You know, I thought about just going back to that album, or the one with Caro Salombra.
No, that's In Through the Outdoor.
Okay, yeah. I thought about listening to one of those and seeing how they held up to me for this very purpose, but I didn't end up doing it. So, sorry.
So, In Through the Outdoor was their last official – well, actually, there was Coda, but – Their last album of new studio material, all new material, was In Through the Outdoor in, I think, 79. And that album is very lackluster, in my opinion, by their standards. There's still some great songs on it, no doubt, but it also has the worst all-time Led Zeppelin song, Carousel Ombre. It also, it kind of meanders at times. It's got a very synth-heavy sound at times, and that's not, it's just not Led Zeppelin to me. In the way that their other, it would easily be my least favorite Zeppelin album. This one, Presence, their second to last original studio album before In Through the Outdoor, third to last if you count Coda, is one that gets overlooked a lot in the Zeppelin pantheon for numerous reasons. Number one, it's following Physical Graffiti, which in many people's minds, including mine, is the best Led Zeppelin album. It's following a string of albums that goes back to their debut. Think about this murderer's row of records to start your career. Led Zeppelin, Led Zeppelin 2, Led Zeppelin 3, Zoso, Houses of the Holy, Physical Graffiti. And this is their follow-up to Graffiti. They'd been out of the studio for quite some time. They'd had a lot of stuff going on. And they come back in towards the end of 75 to record this. And music was changing. Punk rock was taking over, was becoming very popular. Ironically enough, appropriately enough, rather, for this list, this was the lowest-selling studio album by the band. So, Zeppelin's trying to come back with some sort of an answer for what's going on in punk rock. Now, rather than going what you might think they would go, which is to shorten all their songs to sort of change their sound, change their style, they double down. They open this album with one of their longest studio songs, which is Achilles' Last Stand. It's also one of their best studio songs.
It's incredible, yeah.
It is a tour de force. This was the last time, in my opinion, that everyone in the band performs at an A level. Plant's vocals have changed. That's one of the things that you'll notice about this album. Comparing it to the previous album is just how much Robert Plant's voice has changed over the course of 2 or 3 years. It's certainly different. It's more of what we would hear from modern Robert Plant. But he still sings raw. He still sings fiery on this album. Jimmy Page, his playing is still really good here, even great on some of these songs. Think particularly of Achilles' Last Stand, Nobody's Fault But Mine. For Your Life. His playing on these songs is outstanding. Royal Orleans, even. John Paul Jones is probably peaking as a bass player at this point. He can't miss. He's spectacular. And this may be my pick for the best John Bonham album. Achilles' Last Stand, right out of the gates, is a masterpiece. One of the best Zeppelin songs. It's a 10-minute and 30-second long song that feels like it's only 4 or 5 minutes. It's so damn good. It holds up across the board. For Your Life, which is a song that we actually heard as a warm-up or kind of playing before an Alter Bridge concert that we went to.
Nice.
I think
was that the Tabernacle?
Yeah, I believe so. It's the one that's like bam
okay.
Yeah, really great song, Addiction, and another just it just right out of the gates. This album has this, for lack of a better term, this sort of pounding rhythm section, the pounding drums of Bonham, the pounding bass of Jones, and these beautiful little clever kind of dirty electric guitar licks coming up over top of them. Plant's vocals, of course, complementing Page's guitar perfectly. Royal Orleans is a great song, a great little tune that actually is one of the few songs in Zeppelin's catalog that is attributed from a writing standpoint to all four members of the band. John Bonham, John Paul Jones, Jimmy Page, and Robert Plant all have a writing credit on Royal Orleans. That's nice. It's very involved effort. Only a 58-second song, but it's great. It's clever. It's tricky. Really good. Nobody's Fault But Mine, another one of those Zeppelin classics that everybody knows.
Oh, yeah.
But but one that stands out for the guitar work and the drums in particular. Candy Store Rock is a throwback 1950s style a song that is really a showcase for Robert Plant more than anything else, and Jimmy Page. But another fun song from them. Hot Song for Nowhere has a really interesting drum beat to it, drum pattern to it, where it kind of makes you think it's going in one direction, goes in another direction. Funk guitar layered over top of it, and then T for One is that, you know, that Zeppelin, you know, 9 to 10 minute long blues song that they like to put on these records. This was sort of an updated Since I've Been Loving You. It's not as good as Since I've Been Loving You, but it's still really, really good. And another one of those, you know, again, probably the last classic Zeppelin blues song that was a new studio recording. So top to bottom, I think this is a record that is much better than its reputation. It's the least bought Zeppelin album. It's the least talked about Zeppelin album, but it's one that I think I think it's much better than its follow-up, which gets more praise and more attention. I think there's not a weak track on this record for my money. I listen to all of these songs and love them all. I think if there is a weak track, the weakest one is probably T for One, actually, but they're all good songs, and in the case of Achilles, in the case of For Your Life, in the case of Nobody's Fault But Mine, I think they're three all-time great Zeppelin songs, and Hot Song for Nowhere and Royal Orleans, if we ever do a list of underrated hidden gem songs, might make my list. So yeah, David, for me, I knew when we did this list, I had to get this album on here, because this is an album 10 years ago, I didn't like this album. This was always one of those Zeppelin albums that I didn't listen to, that I dismissed as late era Zeppelin, where Plant's voice sounds weird and they just don't sound like themselves, and I wrote it off. And then in the last decade, I've had a chance to listen to this repeatedly over the years, and every time I listen to it, I like it more. It's an album that actually raises in my esteem the more I listen to it. And it's never gonna crack those classics that I mentioned earlier. It's not gonna crack what they did from 68 to 75. But I would take this over just about any hard rock album that has come out. Essentially, that's how much I love Zeppelin. But I love these guys so much, and this album represents them still at their peak, still at their pinnacle before drugs and alcohol and everything else kind of took its toll to me on the last record.
Nice. It's one I know I've listened to, and I know I'll probably know at least half of these songs off listening, going back to, but Achilles Last Stand and Nobody's Fault But Mine, I definitely remember those pretty quickly. Now, you mentioned one of my favorite songs, Since I've Been Loving You.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what are your thoughts on their B-side for that, Since I Started Kind of Sort of Liking You?
You know, it didn't do as well, David, as that song did. They tried it out, actually, at one of their live shows in Greenland, on a rare tour of Greenland that I have a bootleg of. And, you know, the audience wasn't kind to it, quite honestly. They started pelting the stage with tomatoes and cucumbers. Why is it always tomatoes, by the way? I've never understood that.
I guess because they smashed, maybe it wouldn't hurt as badly as...
I guess, but I mean, if you're that upset that you're willing to pelt someone with a fruit or vegetable, then, you know, you would think that you wouldn't care that much about their physical well-being. Or you could throw something different, like a kiwi or something. You know, you can buy a couple of kiwi really cheap.
You're going to throw a New Zealander at the stage?
Yeah. Like I said, you can buy them cheap, and you throw them at the stage. You know?
Chuck them up there. Hey, I think somebody on the Pop Network has at least a few kiwi listeners, so that's nice to them.
You know? And yeah, that's actually us over at HTF Studios, because of my great New Zealand accent that I'm able to affect at a moment's notice. But yeah, so that one didn't do as well. But no, that it's an album that stands up to me, and one that I was actually just listening to today to make sure, absolutely certain, that I still liked it, and I do. And I would invite people to listen to it and give it a fair shake, and let me know your thoughts. I know one criticism that I agree with is there's a couple of these songs that probably could have been, not Achilles, but there's a couple of these songs that probably could have been shortened a little bit, but they're still great songs. And that's ultimately what matters to me.
Right. Yes, I'm not trying to take away attention from the album at all, but that came to me, and I was like, I have to share that. It's funny, at least to me. the whole non-committal nature of it would have been great. I mean, it's probably truly how they felt about some of the groupies, so, you know.
No doubt. They wrote a song on Physical Graffiti called Sick Again that is about encounters with groupies, so.
Nice. Well, I think you might have figured this one out. Maybe not. I think you mentioned this band probably would be on my list. It is the band Silverchair, and it is their very last album, Young Modern.
Young Modern! I was going to make a Young Modern joke in the last track, the last album you mentioned, David, because you said something about modern, and I was almost said Young Modern, and I was like, I'm going to hold on this. He might put it on his list. This almost made my list as well.
Nice! Yeah, I remember you liking this one a good bit, because I remember introducing it to you, because this album took a while to grow on me. I remember it came out internationally a good bit before it came out in America. So I remember through MySpace or something, I was checking it out, and at first I was just like, ooh, I don't know about this. And but of course, when it was available in America, I bought like the deluxe edition with the DVD behind the scenes and everything, and, which, by the way, was one of the most disappointing little behind the scenes. It was like 21 minutes. So not kind of worth the extra money for that disc. It was like, anyway, a lot extra. But this album is so great. And one thing you got to appreciate about Silverchair, they start out as a hard rock band that progressed in a little bit more towards metal on their second album. Then they bring an orchestra on their third, a lot more orchestra on their fourth. This fifth one, there's some orchestral moments on it, but you never would have heard any of those first couple albums and ever thought that would have made it here. Like,
no, it's almost like Europop or something.
Yes,
you know,
at times. But yeah. It also has some kind of classic rock feelings at times in the orchestra. It is such an interesting album. It starts out, the first song I'm not crazy about, that's Young Modern Station. It's probably the weakest one. But that goes into one of their greatest singles, Straight Lines.
Yeah, I was going to say that song and that video really stand out as one of their great works to me.
And one thing I love about this album is he finally looks healthy, because I know he went through anorexia problems in the late 90s, early 2000s. Then his rheumatoid arthritis made it difficult for him to tour around Diorama.
This is Daniel Johns, the lead singer.
Yes, Daniel Johns. He had a lot of health problems. But this one, he finally, he'd put on some muscle. I think he got some treatment prior for some addiction problems, most likely. And, he seemed happier and healthy. He definitely looked healthier. Like I said, he finally had some meat on his bones. Because he was, ridiculously rail thin because of his anorexia back I want to say during Neon Ballroom. I can't remember for sure. But anyway, so to see him look happy, healthy, writing some music that sounded a little more hopeful. Because, they have some ultra-depressing stuff in their catalog. But this album, it's got a lot of hope in it. If You Keep Losing Sleep is a bizarre song, but it's beautiful. Reflections of a Sound is beautiful and very catchy. Then it kind of almost turns briefly into a Beatles album with songs with different movements and stuff. Those Thieving Birds, Strange Behavior, and it closes out with Those Thieving Birds Part 2. You got to listen to it. If you can appreciate different music, try it out. Waiting All Day, The Man That Knew Too Much. There's just some awesome stuff here. And then All Across the World is a cool way to close it out. I actually missed over Mind Reader's a fun rock song. I imagine the band breaking up after this was partly Daniel Johns wanting to do something different, but I imagine the drummer was a little bored on this album compared to some of the others. There's a couple of songs there's not a lot to do, but it is a great album that, once again, if you can appreciate stuff outside of mainstream and appreciate bands being able to change, this is a great album.
Yeah, totally.
because a lot of bands are going to do a lot of the same stuff over and over again. Daniel Johns is one of the most creative musicians out there. He, at least in the modern era, he gets sick of doing that. Like, he can't stand doing that. And honestly, I think he hates most of their early music, or at least the first album or two. Definitely the second one. He was talking about that one being just a bad time. And he looks bad, just feels it's childish. That was Freak Show, the album. But anyway, yeah, this is it's a great album. Like I said, it might not hit you immediately, but if you let it play a couple times, I guarantee at least a couple of tracks could hit with you.
Yeah, I agree with this. It's a record that I know a lot of us were probably like taken aback by the first time that we listened to it. Because we're like, wow, this is not the sound we would have expected coming from Silverchair. But again, I think that's the point to your what you were saying a moment ago. I think Daniel Johns and Silverchair are a band that a lot of people probably haven't thought about since the 90s. But if you follow their discography, they change with each album. Every album for them is either a progression or just going in a different direction and trying something new. And they don't do it to be gimmicky. They don't do it to be again, trendy. They do it because they want to be musically challenged. They don't want to fall into the rut of doing the same music over and over and over again. And Young Modern, to me, is one of my favorite of this style. This style of music isn't necessarily my thing, per se, but the way they pull it off on this record is fantastic. And I say style, but it's hard to even pin it down to one particular style to what you were saying earlier. And yeah, it's a great album, a great record, and I would recommend people to give it a try too. It may not be your thing, but at the very least, it should give you some awareness and respect for this band, because we may never get another Silverchair record. But what they gave us was several really good albums that I would never have heard of if not for my friendships with you and Russell and Sam Neely.
Yeah.
You know, you guys really turned me on to this band, particularly the Diorama album. And I went back and listened to their older stuff. I knew the song, was it called Tomorrow? Their hit from the first album. But I had not heard anything else from them. So going back and listening to all their other albums, I've come to appreciate them as sort of a modern band that takes more chances than most others are willing to take. So, big fan of this album.
Yeah, they're a band that's largely known for their highly successful first album, Frog Stomp, and the song Tomorrow off of it. Then Year 2000 off of Neon Ballroom did pretty well. And that's what brought them to my attention. I miss Frog Stomp and Freak Show completely. But Neon Ballroom came out in high school, and I noticed it and loved it. And so then college happened, and that's when I got into Diorama, which is still my favorite of their albums. But yeah, they're just incredible. He's got one of the best voices, such great control. And so yeah, I knew this was an album I wanted to talk about. Funny enough, I did not notice until like while we were recording that the last two albums I talked about were two that I wrote an article for the Trop Bone. Revelations was the first one I ever wrote for the Trop, and mm-hmm. this might have been the last one. I'm not sure. But it was definitely one of them. Yeah, I didn't making this list. I had no idea where I was going with it other than, that Highway Companion was going to be on it. And then quickly afterwards, I thought about, the Weird Al album, Mandatory Fun, mainly because of that closeout song I talked about so much. But like, I didn't have an era in mind. I didn't really know. And so it's just where my crazy brain takes me over the last month or so is how this list got made. It wasn't until yesterday I realized, oh man, everything's from the 2000s. Because that was not intentional. Because anybody that knows me knows I love a lot of old music. But yeah, didn't happen this time.
Well, it worked out pretty good because my list was loaded with old music. So,
right.
It worked out to have a good balance here.
Yeah, I think so too. I have no clue what my next topic will be. At some point, I know I will have Todd on to do REM. And other than that, like, there's a lot of ideas out there, but I've got to need to finalize them and get up with people and schedule. Scheduling is probably my worst thing ever on. and a little thing about me, I normally record on the weekends just because I'm tired after a day of work, and sometimes I'm alive on a weeknight, but it's typically better to do the weekend, so that makes scheduling a lot more difficult. But anyway, one last time I wanted to throw out some love to Todd. He does a great job over here on the Pop Feed, posting all of our shows on all the various formats. Tons of great stuff out there to listen to. You'll hear in just a second, once I finally stop talking, Straight Lines will probably play us out by Silverchair. But, Greg, is there? How can people reach you?
People can tweet me at gphillips8652. That is G-P-H-I-L-L-I-P-S 8652. People can drop me a line on the loneliest email address on the internet, gregp@placetobenation.com. And another great way to get in contact with me is to go to our Place to Be Nation Comics Facebook page. Just go to your Facebook browser and go to the search bar, type in Place to Be Nation Comics, and you will find us. Join the club and join the discussion there. I'm always I actually get notifications on posts there, so if you want to talk to me, that's a good way to do it. And other than that, if you send a smoke signal, I may or may not see it.
And I misspoke earlier. I have 61 followers on Twitter. That's a little bit higher than 51. you can find me if you want to speak to me, Sunday Groove PTB on Twitter. I plan to get a little more active on there in the future. I'd taken a little time away from it, but I kind of want to get back to it. You can definitely find me, David Sunday, on Facebook. If you do have me, send me a message, because if I don't know who you are, don't have any mutual friends, I'll definitely want to have a conversation before adding you on that kind of social media. Twitter, of course, anybody can follow me. But if you listen to the show for real, do reach out. I love hearing from people. And as I've said before, if you want to do it in a public forum like Twitter, or if you just want to message back and forth, that's cool too. I just love getting feedback. So I know some people are very private people and don't do a lot of social media. So anyway, I appreciate everybody for listening. Greg, thank you so much for guesting. You're always a whole lot of fun on here. And like I said, pay attention to the Pop and Wrestling feeds. There's tons of great stuff on there. And who knows what I'll be doing in the future. I'm trying to stay monthly and not do the same thing over and over again. So who knows what I'll have next month for you. But I'll definitely be back. So y'all take care, and I will catch you in the room.